Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry, with host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
Quintessential Listening Poetry, a different kind of poetry call-in show. Tonight's very special guest is poet Marianne Silk. Marianne, are you on the line?
I am. I'm afraid my cat Alma might be trying to get on the line as well.
Okay, all right. Well, tell Thelma I said hello.
Thelma, Michael says hello.
I'd like to share some information about you, Marianne. You're a phenomenal poet, a phenomenal woman. Marianne is a professor of English and reading at Montgomery College in Rockville, Maryland, and was a member of the famed DC Poetry Project. She also edits The Song Is, a blog zine for poetry and prose inspired by music, especially jazz, and she belongs to the DC Poetry Spot and the DC Poetry Magic Theater. This summer, she and her husband started It Takes a Community, poetry workshop at Montgomery College in Rockville. Her first chapbook, Listening to the Electric Cambodia, Looking Up at Trees of Heaven, is available online at Kind of a Hurricane Press. Her second chapbook, I Dream of Empathy, is available on Amazon. Her poems have appeared in Scarlet Leaf Review, Of and With Bird's Thumb, Cactifer, Mad Swirl, Setu, Philodago, Redbird's Chapbook Weekly Read, and Resurrection of a Sunflower, an anthology of works responding to Vincent van Gogh's art. Her full-length book, On the Other Side of the Window, is now available from Sky Poetch. Is that correct, Marianne?
Skis Poetch, I think it is.
Okay, Ski Poetch and Amazon. She invites you to stop by her blog zine and perhaps even submit some poems. And the blog zine, the address is thesongis.blogspot.com. Marianne, we welcome you to Quintessential Listening. It is so, so, so fantastic to have you with us tonight.
Thanks so much. It's fantastic that your radio show is back.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It's back because of good people like yourself.
Oh, thank you.
I'd like to do to start this journey is ask the question, what sparked your initial love of poetry?
I think what really got me into poetry is that it's a way of painting with words. And, I used to like to paint, mostly paint and not really draw, and make collages. And I find that poetry is a way that I can do it with words. Like I can sketch with words.
Why do you think that poetry is important in general?
I think that it's important as self-expression, as something for people to make, something for people to listen to. It's a way for people to travel to other places and, you know, get the perspective of other people. I think it's very concentrated. It's not as lengthy as reading a novel. You know, you can listen to a poem and you'll be transported.
Okay, I do understand that. What is, as you think about your poetry and all, in terms of all of your work, what are some of the predominant themes of your work?
I think probably it's a tension, as I said in my second book, I Dream of Empathy. It's a tension between first and third and sometimes second person. I have a lot of poems about the environment. I have a number of poems about the ocean. Place is very important, but, you know, also the experience of living in a place and being a person who lives in a particular place. So, although, you know, history is important too. I have some poems where time is particularly important.
Well, what I'd like us to do at this point, Marianne, is for you to share some of your work.
Okay. Shall I start with September 11th, 2001?
Yes.
Okay. In fact, my husband's here to listen to me read it. This is Lafayette, September 11th, 2001. It's from when my husband and I were newlyweds, living in Lafayette, Indiana, learning about the events of that day, and being on the periphery, really. Okay. Later that morning, after classes were canceled, I crossed the river beneath a perfect sky, going home to you. We didn't think that Al-Qaeda would reach us in this college town, this pin that the angels danced on. We listened to the radio. We thought about stopping by your parents. There your mother watched the news all day, as if it were the rain that would not fall. Instead, I watched the trucks trailing American flags rush up and down Ferry Street, making it a river we could not cross. I wish it had rained that morning, while the passengers were lining up at Logan and the workers were streaming from the subway. Standing at the window, looking at the sky, fierce even in Lafayette, city of wedding cake houses and candy stores, I prayed for rain. Okay, that's it.
Right. Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, and I think another poem that goes with it is also about Lafayette. It is Dreams of Lafayette, and I did that and sure that, you know, it looked like it looked like it was in Lafayette. It turns out I think it was in Kentucky, but that's kind of the same part of the, you know, the country. So, you know, some of the buildings are kind of similar. Okay. Dreams of Lafayette. St. Boniface's narrow slate spire punctures the clouds in the sky. Inside these apartments, grad students read literary theory. Espresso machines rattle and Diet Coke chills. A couple calmly speaks French. His blue bike waits outside. It is ready for him to leave this Hoosier city for someplace on the coast. Trains shook our wooden house on Ferry Street every night. I would dream of earthquakes, shattering windows and ceilings crumbling in apartments I once lived in. When we couldn't get back to sleep, we graded papers. We drove to the all-night village pantry across 6th Street's tracks. Now the trains are gone, rerouted beyond the highway and strip malls. The village pantry closes at 10. I dream of Lafayette, living in these sturdy buildings, strong enough to protect us and our child. The bike, the one color, the metallic shimmer of sky in this black and white world is yours. End. Okay.
What made you feel that you needed to express yourself this way, Marianne?
I think probably because words are more my strength than, you know, painting. I've never tried sculpture, than music. I took a little piano back in junior high, but, you know, I think words are more my strength. And, you know, for a while I wanted to write fiction, but I think I'm not really a very plot-oriented writer. I do better with character, atmosphere, setting, that sort of description, that sort of thing. I did try to write a novel years ago, and it kind of fizzled.
All right. So what do you believe has been the qualitative difference between poetry and fiction?
I think in fiction you have to be willing to do things to your characters or to let things happen to your characters. You have to have plot. It especially nowadays, people are not going to want to read your book unless it's a murder mystery or a thriller. And I think with poetry, you can write slice of life poetry. I do write some science fiction poetry, but most of my poetry is slice of life. It may not be myself. It may be somebody else. I've written some poems about famous figures, sometimes famous figures in different situations. I remember years ago I wrote a poem about George Harrison, as if the Beatles had fizzled and he became one of the Funk Brothers in Motown.
All right. Now that is a qualitative difference between being in the Beatles and Motown.
Well, I guess George was probably more collaborative. I think he was able to play well with others, Dylan, the band, Tom Petty, you name it. I think that they were themselves, so they didn't merge as well with other people.
Well, let me ask this question. When you write, do you leave out significant facts? So I guess my question is, are readers supposed to fill in the blanks in your writing?
I don't think so, but that's probably true. That's probably true. And also, I kind of misheard your question. I thought, do you change things around? I think I do, and I think, there are people whom I leave out. I have a brother, but I don't really mention him a lot. I tend to mention my mother's side of the family more. But I do mention my father here and there. My father's still living. I'm a little more careful about what I mention.
I can understand. So in terms of your poetry, in terms of it being very, very personal, there are some poems that you will not put into print.
Right, right.
Well, let's take a brief break, Marianne, and we'll be right back.
Okay.
My name is Michael Anthony Ingram. I'd like to welcome you again to Quintessential Listening Poetry. We're here with our very special guest, Marianne Silk. She's a fantastic poet. She's also a good friend, so I'm really glad that she's with me tonight. Marianne, so often they make the statement that in terms of complete honesty, one should look to comedians, artists, and poets. What do you think emerges naturally from your work?
I think probably, my concern for place, my concern for the environment. I hope empathy. I haven't had any complaints that I'm being unfair to people, but they might not be saying them, expressing that to me. Actually, my ex-husband liked that book, I Dream of Empathy. I haven't heard what he thinks about my current book. That there are some poems where he doesn't come off as well.
Okay.
In them.
I can understand. Mm-hmm. Well, will you favor us again with a set of poems?
Sure. I think I'm actually going to read from, instead of reading from my current book, I'm going to read from My Dream of Empathy because, well, you know, I was thinking I wanted to read some of the poems I used to read at the DC Poetry Project. And, of course, I'm going to read Crepuscule with Callie. And my poem about my cat Callie's worst nightmare, which is to live in the house of the jazz baroness who lived with Thelonious Monk, the jazz pianist, and a lot of cats anyways. You know, Callie was upset when Thelma came. She would be very upset in that house.
Okay.
Crepuscule with Callie. Waves of scent wash over her. Urine, human and animal, sweat, damp wool, bad coffee, no cream, worse cigarettes, a perfume called joy. A landscape quakes, calico, tuxedo, gray, orange, white, black, tabby, Manx. The notes on the record skip as the landscape shimmers and shifts. Chase or be chased, nip or be nipped, lick or be licked. The other cats multiply. They leap onto counters and crowd around windows. Lights twinkle with kindness out there. Inside, the cats multiply, sniffing at cold coffee cups and ashtrays, chasing, nipping, licking. Behind the last door, the man in the suit and hat will not stir. He barely breathes. They say that one night, he played the piano with his elbows while the sax wailed like a car alarm from the future. Another night, he did not play at all. If she were herself, she'd rattle the blinds until he awoke and let her out of this nightmare. He doesn't have to play the piano for her. Just get her out. Again, the landscape shifts. The record skips. Beyond the last door, Callie still seeks the threads of her waking life. No coffee, no cigarettes, no chasing, nipping, licking, the presence of real joy. And
okay. I like that, Marianne.
Oh, good. Yeah, I remember how much fun
it was. Well, you were recently interviewed by someone at Montgomery College, and you shared that particular piece.
Yes, yes. Yeah, but Melissa is a real cat fan, and she has a bookstore. It's online right now, and her two cats, Stan Lee and Spencer, are integral parts of the bookstore.
Right,
you know,
right.
Stan Lee is always giving discounts.
Okay. Personification.
And, even though my mother did not like cats, I want to read a poem about my mother because, you know, I talked about poems about my family, and
yes.
I think this is the quintessential poem about my mother. It's about her driving with us to Fitchburg, where she grew up, Fitchburg, Massachusetts. My mother told stories. Our mother remembered cars with no radios, so she told stories. We munched on her favorite candy, Necco wafers, the color and flavor of spring coat buttons, muted pastels, pink, gray, white, green. She told stories all the way past the road to Whalen Park. Its wooden roller coaster, she said, had killed a soldier just home from the war. She told stories as we crossed over the Nashua River, that ran red or blue or green, depending on the paper Wallace's mill was making. As a girl in a pinafore, my grandmother had waded in that water. Mother told stories as she drove past the site of Mal's Goody Goody, where she used to play under the tables while the adults played bridge and slipped the children pennies and Necco wafers to match their Sunday best, muted pastels, plaids, and checks. Our mother told stories, all the way to grandmother's house. We sat in the front seat, crunching the last of the wafers, discs less sweet than our breakfast cereal. We hoped for more, but sometimes tasted the pale licorice, pale lavender that mother recalled. Okay.
All right. In terms of that particular piece, you repeated the line, my mother told stories. Why was it important to emphasize?
Yeah, because she certainly did tell stories. And actually, probably, you know, when she was starting to get Alzheimer's, she would constantly be telling all these stories. You know, I did this, I did this. I remember when I was teaching. I remember when I was working at this resort and so on and so forth. You know, my father and I couldn't get word in edgewise. I mean, not that necessarily we wanted to, but, you know,
okay.
Constantly.
Well, let me ask this question. Where do you hail from?
I grew up in Shrewsbury, Massachusetts, which is a suburb of Worcester, which is in the middle of Massachusetts, and it is especially back then when I grew up in the 60s and 70s, it was not Boston. It was much more ethnic. It was much more working class. You know, it's true that, you know, Boston can be a little rough around the edges, but you know, Worcester was even more so.
Well, let me ask this question. How has your poetic worldview changed from your early beginnings?
And I guess, you know, from my early beginnings, I used to write poetry about, you know, 30 years ago. I think it's my world has kind of widened, that I've been to more places, I've lived in more places. I think, you know, I've interacted with more diverse people. I think I've looked at different perspectives. Probably my next book will have some more Fitchburg poems. I don't think I have any Fitchburg poems in my current book, but in the, you know, last summer I wrote a bunch of poems about going back to Fitchburg, which I did in 1996, and, you know, going back mentally. 1996 was the last time I was in Fitchburg. But, you know, mentally going back and, you know, imagining that my grandmother was still around at the age of 107, which, you know, she wasn't.
Your new book, On the Other Side of the Window, tell me more about your book. And it's available
okay.
on Amazon.
On Amazon, that's the place. Because actually, you know, the editors have a nice page, but, you know, if you want to buy it, you have to go to Amazon.
Nowhere.
It actually took a while for me to get this book together, to bring it together, to put all the poems in the right order, and to choose the right poems. And it's a very diverse book. That there are four main themes. I begin with the environmental poems, looking out at Earth. I have nature poems. Originally, this book was nature poetry, nature on the other side of the glass. And my husband says, well, you know, for a nature poet, you're never outside. And I think that takes advantage of that. I have Between Two Worlds, which some of them are personal poems, but others are persona poems. So I have a poem about Charlotte Smith, a poet and novelist I've written about. I have a poem about Dorothy Ashby, the jazz harpist, whom I've written about. I have a poem about Gene Clark, the 60s musician. So it's not all personal, and I guess I have a poem about Brian Wilson's wife as well. And then the last section, always looking at the past, sometimes living by the river, those are the really personal poems. Those are, you know, most of them are poems about my experience, and that's probably the section that my ex-husband might not be too keen on, continued.
Okay. Well, I'm sure that he'll he'll probably read it now.
He might. I don't know if he's going to be listening, because I publicized the show on Facebook.
Okay.
If you get an irate person from Boston.
I will know who it is. Well, let me ask this question. How does a poem begin with you? Does it begin with an idea, a form, or an image? How do you begin a poem?
Well, sometimes it begins with a dream. You know, I've written several poems that have begun as dreams. One poem in the new book, The Last Day, The Day Before the Bridge Closed, that began as a dream that I had, that I had worked at Long Island Hospital in Boston, which was basically, one big nursing home at that point. I worked at a nursing home in Boston, but, not at Long Island. And Long Island was interesting because the only way you could get there was to drive over a bridge. And recently, the bridge closed, so now you can't get on the island. I think it's basically a feral island now. Other poems, begin as ideas. Sometimes they begin as lines. Sometimes, really early on, they began as my trying to approach a theme in kind of a Hurricane Press's anthologies. Sometimes, the poems begin when I look at a painting or I decide, I want to write about this period in my life or that period. So the poems begin in many, many different ways.
Right. Now, in terms of your process of writing, is it primarily pen and paper, computer, notebook? How do you write?
I start by using pen and a notebook. I write longhand. I do maybe 1, 2, 3 drafts. Then I go to the computer, and once I'm on the computer, it's kind of hard to tell because sometimes I will peck at poems. I will not really, I don't think do a draft, but I will peck at the poem until it's different. Sometimes, I will take lots of different drafts. Sometimes I will add things, sometimes I will take a lot away. And in fact, there was recently I had a poem, it was probably about 30 lines, and I got it down to 4 or 5. I turned the poem into kind of a haiku, which was appropriate.
Well, based
because,
on the poems, please continue, I'm sorry.
Because it was a poem in memory of a friend of mine who died recently, and she was a haiku poet. She was always trying to get me to write haiku and haibun, but I never really, during her lifetime, I never really felt confident, and I guess now that she's gone, I've done a little bit of haiku. I've done haibun. In fact, I read one last week.
When you write, what else comes to mind, Marianne?
Well,
I'm sure your life experiences, as you said.
Yeah. And, I think also, part of the writing process, I have a structure for the poem. I guess, the structure oftentimes is, free verse.
Mm-hmm.
So... But, I'll come back and I'll add details. And sometimes, I think I want more sensory detail. I want more smell. I want more touch. Other times, I think, this is a very plain poem about this time in my life. What can I, what can I do to add? So, that's oftentimes what goes through in my mind. Sometimes, I want to add in music. Oh, another thing that has inspired me is oftentimes music.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't write so many music poems this summer, but towards the end, it crept back in.
Your poetry is very lyrical.
Oh, thanks.
Let me
ask this question. Oh.
Yes, please, please. I can ask questions all night. Oh, please.
Okay.
please read.
Yeah. I think maybe I'll read a few more lyrical poems. I think I'd like to read The Day Before the Bridge Closed. And then there's another Boston poem I'd like to read, too. The Day Before the Bridge Closed. On Boston's Long Island, I walk over unmarked graves of residents, now lost in earth and rocks, hidden like they have always been, at this hospital, in their neighborhoods, before the city gentrified. I stand at the island's edge, looking out to waves that smells of rot and seaweed. The ragged tide rolls in from Spain, leaving green sea glass on this beach. Seagulls hover over the prickly waves unraveling, over green shards worn smooth. Tomorrow, only ghosts will watch. End. Okay, I think also I want to read one of my old poems. It's another ocean poem. I guess this is the theme right now.
Okay.
And it is Seaweed on the Beach. And that actually is one of my father's favorite poems because it happens to be about Maine. Specifically York Beach, Maine, where he and my mother were retired. Seaweed on the Beach. Reds, greens, browns, and mustard yellow add earthy undertones, the taste of miso, to the neons, the overexposed blues and whites and yellows, the painted plaques and T-shirts, the stick candies and saltwater taffy sold at the gift store, the rusty Irish moss on this beach will not turn into anemones or coral or even amber sea glass. It lingers like the seagull accents wheeling in the wind past summer. Okay.
You know, based on what I've heard so far, as I think about your poetry, the lines seem to be relatively short. Are they meant to be really slow?
Although my voice isn't always slow.
Okay. Okay.
Well, shall I read a poem with longer lines?
Yes, please. Well, let me ask one question first.
Oh, sure.
What is the relationship between your speaking voice and your written voice? As you just said, what's the relationship?
Well, I'm trying to read in a more polished manner. I'm trying. You know, it's not quite my teacher voice. You know, my teacher voice. I'm trying to project. I guess I'm trying to project now too. But I'm with my reading voice. I want to serve the poem. I guess, you know, with Seaweed on the Beach, for example, I probably could let my New England accent creep back in.
Okay.
But I don't know if it would necessarily serve the poem. Be interesting, you know, I have this poem about Worcester. It would be interesting if I try to let, you know, my accent creep back in there. Because
right.
I guess that would add a little bit of the flavor of Worcester because, you know, people who grow up there, at least when I grew up there and when my father grew up there, have really strong accents. You know, I'm not, you know, probably less so now, definitely less so now. My brother does not have the same kind of accent I did. You know, he sounds like an East Coaster, but, you know, he doesn't speak the same way I did back then.
Well, before you read again, let's take a brief commercial break, and we'll be right
back.
My name is Michael Anthony Ingram. This is Quintessential Listening Poetry. The call-in number, if you have questions for Marianne, is 646-787-1631. My name is Michael Anthony Ingram, and this is Quintessential Listening Poetry. We're back with the fantastic Marianne Silk. Please, Marianne, share some more of your work.
Okay, great. The poem I want to read now, it seems like all I'm doing is reading poems about the ocean, but actually maybe I will read a poem about the desert. It's
all right.
Sophia, What Might Have Been, and this poem actually wound up in an anthology about drought, and it's about, you know, I guess how this poem began. I was imagining, what if I had stayed out west? What if I had been experiencing the drought? Sophia, What Might Have Been. She tends her lawn of rocks and cacti, the grass and flowers long since dead, the fruit and avocado trees, brittle sticks, cut down, bundled, and left at the curb. On the other side of a magnifying glass, the sun scrutinizes her. She sniffs, she coughs, she scans the mountains for smoke. It is always creeping into her palms, her dreams, her hair, her clothes. Although she tells herself that what she sees is just haze, she will not have to leave home. She will not have to sleep among strangers. Still, she tastes her fears, the black that bitters, the hiss in the garden. There is nothing more to burn, nothing more. All of her writing hides in the cloud. With the books and music she loves most, she has long since lived alone. There is nothing left to burn. Sipping bottled water from Minnesota, a package a college friend has sent her, she remembers his letter, her house, herself. There is always something left to burn. The end.
There's always something left to burn.
Mm.
I agree with that 100%.
Yeah.
I just received.
Shall I read another drought poem?
Yes, please,
okay.
Please.
This is, I guess, kind of about, it's kind of chiding my love of apocalyptic landscape. I think sometimes my poetry can be a little apocalyptic.
Okay.
And one of the places affected by the dreadful drought in California was the Salton Sea, which basically dried up. We disaster tourists travel to the Salton Sea. Last year's flowers stand, sunbleach kindling for the fire about to happen here. Blue sky flames, a torch in the earth's hands. The sun is the white-hot center. No one smokes. Engines do not idle. Air effaces smells of death and life. All that remains in the sea's heart will never quench the flames we wait for. We wait small sips of bottled water, then wait some more. We tourists fly from disaster to disaster, our quick flights adding fuel to the flames. End.
Adding fuel to the flames.
Mm.
I have one more question before you continue with your journey.
Sure.
your poetry, again, is very lyrical. When you think about writing, what kind of work are you most drawn to? Meaning, do you find yourself reading work similar to your own or different or completely different?
I would say it's probably, you know, the works I enjoy reading are relatively similar. You know, for example, well, her subject matter is not similar. You know, I was reading a book by Sandy Leibovitz, a poet from New York, who's going to be coming to Rockville in November, by the way.
Okay.
And
all right.
She writes about fantasy and myth and fairy tales. But I think her approach is probably, you know, relatively close to mine. You know, we both write free verse. There is some structures, you know, there is craft. You know, image is important. And, you know, I really enjoyed her book. I, you know, of course, you know, you may or may not know from reading the my review, I enjoyed reading Mary Stone Hanley's book. I think, you know, it was great to act, you know, to return to some old friends and, you know, to see poems that, you know, were new to me as well. You know, other poets I've enjoyed, you know, I like Philip Dacey for his humor. Although actually I've only owned one book of his. Maybe if I like him so much, I should buy another. Earlier this summer, I was reading poetry by Kazim Ali and Keshav Akbar. I heard them read, and it, you know, it was fantastic. I think that they're more free associative than I am, and they're more out there. So you know, it was kind of freeing to read them. And last summer, I read Ross, you know, a book by Ross Gay. His poems are more actually rangy, but you know they were really fun to read. And a while back, I read Abdul Ali's book of poems, Trouble Sleeping, and that was the first book I actually read cover to cover. You know,
what made it different?
I just couldn't stop reading.
What made it different?
Pardon?
What made it different that you wanted to read it cover to cover?
Well, you know, oftentimes when I'm reading a book of poems, you know, I read a couple poems and then I put it down. Or I read three or four poems, I put it down. But when I was reading Abdul Ali's book, you know, I just wanted to continue to see what he was going to do. I was just, you know, I was swept away by his language and his imagery. And, you know, his journey. You know, he's a bit younger than I am, but, you know, it was a very interesting journey.
You know, when I think about your work, your poems have amazingly detailed titles. And what role should a title play in a poem?
I think it's a way, you know, it's a hook. It's something that should complement the poem. You know, I change titles. Let me see if there's you know, Crepuscle with Callie. That was always that title. In the book, a lot of the titles, you know, they're the titles that the poems came with. Actually, you know, the one that really, really, really struck me was I Don't Remember the Willamette. And that, I was looking at my friend B. Garth's painting of the Willamette River. I think it was of the Willamette. It might have been the Columbia. You know, one of those rivers out there. And it really struck me that I remember a lot of my time in Eugene, Oregon, but I don't remember going near the Willamette, and that is such an important river in that city. I had kind of a weird experience in Oregon. I didn't go out to the mountains that often. I didn't go out to the ocean that often. I mostly stayed in the city and wrote poetry and you know, wrote term papers and tried to teach. So, you know, I could have been out in the middle of the cornfield.
Well, sometimes I think we're twins because, again, remember, I lived in Oregon for 14 years.
Ah.
I lived in Corvallis, Oregon.
Ah.
And like you, I rarely had an opportunity or took the opportunity to visit the mountains or the desert or the ocean. I spent most of my time in Corvallis teaching.
Mm.
So I understand. I understand. It's a qualitative difference between what occurs in a small college town and what occurs at the ocean, so to speak.
Mm.
You know, as I'm
thinking about your work. Oh, yes.
No, I was thinking, you've written so much, and I know that all poets have several words that come up over and over again in their sentences that they can't help but use in their work. Are there three absolute favorite words that you use?
Oh, gosh, I think, you know, my favorites kind of, come and go. I've been using remembers a lot. You know, actually,
okay.
You know, for a while I was writing poems where I wrote about where I remember, I don't remember. I remember, I don't remember. I have a lot of water and ocean poems. I also have been writing a lot of poems that have the title Last, you know, the last summer without air conditioning, the last days of fusion. And so on and so forth. I guess, do I have time to read another poem? I should read a positive poem about back in the day.
All right.
The Last Days of Fusion, 55. The Last Days of Fusion. As saxophone and piano washed past doorways, the couple walked down the street, looking to enter places they would have never dared 3 years ago. December snow fell in spurts. She clenched, then unclenched, gray-gloved hands in the pocket of her teal wool coat. His coat was new, too. Already places were shutting down. This was not New York, not Manhattan. His friend Elgar had died, so they couldn't visit him in his three-decker, too close to Harvard Square. In the last days of fusion, the couple walked on Mass Ave, avoiding their memories of Elgar, nights they'd spent drinking tonic and listening to Miles Davis on crackling vinyl, to Elgar cracking his jokes, telling his stories about Cambridge in the 30s. Fine snow became light rain, summoning the smell of damp wool. A guitarist exited the cafe, looking for his car as the last trackless trolley fled down Trapello Road. In doorways, the young men played horns, making the old songs fizz like soda with lime. Okay.
When you write, do you sit and think through every stanza? Or do you write freely and allow the words to just flow?
Ooh, I think probably more think through. You know, sometimes it really flows, but a lot of times I just have to think through. And it would be interesting to take a look at maybe some of the original versions of some of these poems. And you know, there's a lot missing. You know, I focus my palms, and then I expand them, basically.
Well, I think it's time for us to open the lines for callers who have questions for you. Hold on 1 second.
Okay.
Caller, you're on the air. Area code 207. The first three numbers are 290. You're on the air. Hello?
Hi, Valerie. I guess we waited too long.
Well, maybe that caller is here to just listen. So we'll say thank you for tuning in. Marianne, you know, so often when people write poetry, and actually I did receive a tweet, someone wanted to know, where do you write? Where do you write?
Oh, where do I write? Well, at home, I write in, I guess, what I call the back of the house, which is really the living room. You know, I have this chair I sit in, I have this ottoman, and I sit with, you know, I sit either with my notebook or my computer. You know, once in a while I will sit in other chairs. I'll face, and actually last summer I was facing in other directions, but mainly I sit in the back facing east.
All right. Well, we did have someone tweet in a question, so that's very nice.
Oh, very good.
Yes, it's very, very, very nice. Now, back to your book. And actually, I'd like you to end. We've got a few more minutes. I'd like you to end by sharing some more poetry. But back to your book. Do you plan to do any book signings anywhere?
Probably, you know, they're ad hoc book signings. A friend of mine was thinking about arranging a book signing, but, you know, we're still arranging it. But, you know, where if you catch me, I'll sign the book for you.
Okay. If you had to convince a friend or colleague to read your book, what might you tell them about your book?
That's a good question. I think probably, you know, if it's a close friend, I'd say, you know, if you want to know me better, for anybody else, I think probably, you know, it's a way, the book is a way of traveling to different places in different times.
Well, what I'd like you to do at this particular time is to favor us with some other works, please.
Okay. Well, my book opens at Returning to Jamaica Pond.
And
this is in the neighborhood of Boston. I had a friend who lived there. I visit her quite a bit. And I had almost lived in her basement, but I ended up going to Purdue instead. Returning to Jamaica Pond. On this cool day, sunlight hides behind frayed clouds that light turns translucent. Dank, green, brown scent does not rise from the opaque pond as it did on warmer days. After stepping off the outbound trolley swaying into the future, I once walked this pond without stopping, without looking, without reflecting. Pausing for breath, I look out to Turtle Island's rock, over which a dead tree sprawls. This island is shrinking. Rising waters will conceal it long before the ocean covers this growing city, my grave, this shrinking grave, my city. Okay. Actually, do I have time for one more?
Yes, please. I enjoy hearing your work, Marianne.
Okay, great. I want to read the Gene Clark poem, Alternative History in Stanton, Virginia. And Stanton, Virginia is a place where I go with my husband, his sister, and her husband. And it is a really I think it's a cool place. I don't know. People might not. And I love how the whole city is on an incline. And I also love alternative history. As I mentioned, I had the poem where George Harrison works for Motown, but this is a poem where Gene Clark, who died in 1991, you know, he lives. He's alive now. The man who sings my favorite song wanders the streets of this small city. He no longer carries his guitar, too heavy for walking past 70 on uneven brick sidewalks that all run uphill. An ex-smoker, he catches his breath beneath the marquee of the last one-screen movie theater, the one that used to show movies he liked. It reeks of buttered popcorn. He moves on. Past the site of the old Woolworths, the one that sold his records back when they were hits, when they crept out of open windows, even in this mountain town, before they clung to him, never leaving the room with the reel-to-reel tape, never leaving home. Okay.
What I'd like you to do as you think about your entire body of work, if you can, to name the three poems that you're most proud of writing, the ones that you personally cannot forget.
I think My Mother Told Stories. That's one I love reading. You know, it reminds me of my mother. It brings me close to her. Mm-hmm. I think also Crepuscule with Callie. That's yeah. A very entertaining poem. I think, let's see, the September 11th poem. You know, that's a poem I'm proud of.
All right. We're almost at the end of our hour, but do you have one more poem that you can share?
Sure. Okay. Any particular theme that you'd like? Maybe something a little different. I'll do Visiting the Ancestors, because, you know, there I talk about my father's side of the family.
Okay.
And, you know, as well as my mother's. Visiting the Ancestors. The deer are visiting the ancestors, nibbling on grass at Mount Calvary, waiting in the shade of winter, underneath the low trees that could be on a bank in the deep south that the ancestors fled from. The five deer browse on the pale green fringe of the cemetery, limp parsley left on winter's plate, beside the river that neither flows nor freezes. The deer have bodies, the color of earth in shadow, but they could be spirit animals, a family living elsewhere come to visit great-grandparents in the ground. The great-grandfather, who was gentle with farm animals, remembered horses and mules. The great-grandmother, who kept a pot on the stove for family, neighbors, and friends, served red rose tea with milk and sugar like coffee. The deer linger on the fringes like the awkward children they once were when the ancestors were alive. That's it.
When people hear your work, Marianne, I'm sure they usually want more. What's next for you as a poet?
I think, well, you know, probably what's next, you know, I'd eventually, maybe in a year or two, I'd like to do another book. You know, with more of the Fitchburg poems, more other poems. And my husband and I, we talked about doing a poem to, you know, collecting all our poems about our cat, Thelma. And right now, my husband and I are leading this community of writers. It takes a community. And, you know, I'd like to see... you know, where I go with that community that we started the summer, and it's been surprisingly successful.
Well, we've reached the end of our hour. I'd like to thank you so much for being a guest on Quintessential Listening Poetry. Your work is fantastic, as I've said so many different times tonight. It's a pleasure to listen to you, a pleasure to have you answer the questions. I'm sure that I gave you more than one question to think about. But
yes,
your full-length book, On the Other Side of the Window, is available on Amazon. Marianne would also like to invite you to stop by her blog zine and perhaps even submit some poems. And the blog zine, again, is the song is .blogspot.com. Marianne, thank you, and have a wonderful evening.
Thank you, Michael. Take care.
All right. Good night.
Good night.